Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the eighth day of March, and we are thrilled to have you with us on this Monday morning. It is, you know, Mondays can be daunting sometimes, but we have a lot to talk about today. We have a wonderful panel, and I know we will make it undaunting. At least that's the goal. We welcome you to join in. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you on the many issues that we discussed this morning. Let me get to our official introductions of our panel. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I feel officially introduced. And I want to say that I was out there walking. It was very cold, and I am very, very, very happy with what I hear Ray Graff, the great Ray Graff, just saying he's bringing us 50-degree weather soon.
Very nice.
I can't wait. Yeah. I just can't wait.
It'll be very nice.
And I'm getting a ton of mail on Cuomo. I'd say it's running about 95-97 degrees. For Cuomo not resigning, which he says he's not what he doesn't want to do. There are some people who continue to lie and say that I don't talk about Cuomo. I talk about him all the time. I don't have any idea what they're talking about, but I'm happy to be here and happy to be alive.
All right. Now that we have that settled, let's move on to introduce Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. She is an immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Sienna, thank you very much for being here. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Good morning. I'm excited to be here this morning.
Very nice to have you here. Counterterrorism expert and best-selling author Malcolm Nance is in the house. Good morning, Malcolm. How are you?
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you. And political consultant and the wind beneath my wings, Libby Post.
Hey.
How are you?
Well, Joe, I don't know what Kelly would think of that, but thank you so much.
Lynn. That's true. That may be the larger issue there. But it's we love having you all here. Thank you very much. It's terrific to hear your voices this morning. Okay, well, the big story, of course, is still the governor of the state of New York. And these stories seem to come out in the largest numbers over the weekend. In this particular case, it was from Friday night into Saturday, the news was that there were two more allegations that were printed, one by the Washington Post, one by the Wall Street Journal. Then the Times Union came out in their newspaper and editorializing called for the resignation of the governor. Then yesterday, the governor had a press conference in which, for the first time, he addressed the new allegations. And during that, said he has no plans to resign. And he said, "Look, I am here. It is against democracy for me to resign. I was elected by the people of New York. I'm going to do the job of the people of New York. Let us see what happens during the investigation." Then immediately following that, The big news comes out about the top state leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, says that the governor should resign. And then Carl Hasty, seeming to want to have it both ways, did not call for the governor's resignation, but did question the governor's ability to continue to lead the state and said maybe it's time for the governor to consider at least stepping aside. So that is where we are on this Monday morning at 9:16 a.m. Alan, you have talked a little bit about this in your opening remarks, but let's talk about Andrea Stewart-Cousins and what got her to that point and the evolution of the story over the last 10 to 14 days as to what brought her to say, okay, it's time for the governor to resign.
Well, let me put it this way, Joe. I am not a person who wants to talk about what people's motivations are. But I can tell you a couple of things, and that is the mail is astounding to me. It is not balanced. It is, let me just read you a couple. Susan says, I've been hearing concerns that Cuomo puts the state at risk for a Republican governor will pardon Trump for state offenses. I'd like to hear from the experts on the panel on that one. Well, I don't think that's going to happen. And then I heard from Robert, who says, good morning, panel. What are Democrats trying to kill one of the best leaders in New York State ever had? They crucified Churchill. If the governor hadn't been friendly and Italian, he'd be better understood. These people coming forth now are camp followers, opportunistic, hate-filled, sad individuals. We had a note from Roger, who says, so now we expect people to give up their employment in the face of allegations, in quotes. What has become of our justice system? If someone is alleged that Joe mistreated his dog, that would never happen, Joe, I know that. Would he be expected to resign? That's from Roger in Albany.
That's why I posted a picture of my dogs eating off of a whisk yesterday because we were making pudding together.
It was very cute.
Thank you, Libby. Yeah, I knew you would love it.
And so there they are. It's so interesting. Now, I have one more thing to say. I turn it over to my more learned colleagues. But one thing I would tell you is everybody hates the legislature. My first job was with the Eagleton Institute of Politics, and where we studied state legislatures. And governors compared to legislatures always do better in public opinion polls. Now, I don't know what the latest they're going to show here, but I can tell you right now, as the old saying goes, if you're going to kill the king, then you better kill him. And now they are really after him. But you're hearing what this mail is running at, and I wouldn't lie to you.
Libby Post, with that mail in mind, there are also an awful lot of legislators in the state who are calling for the governor to resign. Major newspapers are calling for the governor to resign and step aside. The point being made by Andrea Stewart Cousins is, look, every day something is coming out, every day another allegation, every day another report. Meanwhile, how do we run the state of New York? That seems to be maybe not a practical point, but certainly a fairly realistic one.
Well, I think it's both, to be honest with you. I think it's practical and realistic, if that's not being redundant. And, you know, he doesn't have a lot of political friends, and that's getting more and more obvious, and it's a sad state of affairs, that's for sure. And you know, with Andrew Stewart Cousins is going to stand with women. I mean, she's got an incredible backbone as well as integrity, and she understands the rough and tumble of politics. She started out losing a race by 18 votes in Yonkers years ago, and then came back to win by 1800 votes. And you know, I mean, it was really, she understands what this is. I mean, she cut her teeth, in rough and tumble politics, and has risen to be the Senate Majority Leader, the first woman of color. And, you know, she's right in terms of whether or not he can continue to govern. What we're not talking about are the bad bolts on the Mario Cuomo Bridge. And honestly, I think that scandal could be the ultimate undoing for the governor right now, because that put the health and safety. I mean, so did the COVID. You know, the pandemic, yeah, did too. Yeah. But you know, thousands upon thousands of cars travel across that bridge every day, and they knew that there was problems with the bolts, and nobody did anything about it immediately. And so, I think that could be just adding, you know, fuel to the fire, but that could be the straw that breaks the camel's back,
back. So, Libby, just to be clear, it sounds like you think that Andrew Cuomo should resign.
I think it's untenable. I don't know how he can continue to govern effectively, you know.
So that's a yes. Yes, he should resign, you say.
I want the process to proceed. I want the investigation to proceed, but I just don't know how he can govern effectively.
Well, but on the question of a budget, you may be right. There's going to be a negotiation, and I'm not arguing one way or the other on this, but I'm just asking you that on the basis of allegations, that letter that we just got, on the basis of allegations, you think he should resign?
No, I don't. I think we need to go through the process, but I wonder how effective the governing process will be. I think, we'll see what happens in the budget negotiations and who gets what.
Now, well, you're a lobbyist, right? I'm sorry
yes,
for pursuing
I am.
This. You're a lobbyist, and I have a question for you. Uh-huh. What I said before is everybody hates the legislature. People like their governors, generically, much more than they like the legislature, who they see as people who follow the lead of a speaker or a majority leader and who don't think for themselves, although they always argue strenuously with me when we discuss this. But isn't it sort of untenable for the legislature, which has a smell about it that people resent, to be calling for the resignation of a guy who gives them a hard time?
Okay, so the old adage is, I hate Congress, but I love my congressman.
Right.
That's
I think
right.
The same
exactly.
thing holds true here.
So
we hate the legislature, but I love my legislators. I love my state senator. I love my assembly
right.
person. You know, the fact of the matter is, yeah, I am a lobbyist and I do work with all the branches of government. So it's it gets a little difficult at times. But I have found the legislators that I have worked with to be thoughtful, committed folks.
Well, what else
in
are you going to say?
In general? Well, come on, Alan. I mean,
well, these people are listening. You know
but
they're
it's
listening.
True. Well, that's lovely. But it's also true.
But you've got to do business
with
them.
And I'm talking about the ones that I've worked with directly. Okay. Yeah. But, what I will go back to my old chestnut, I guess is the best way of putting this, is that people really don't understand how government works anymore. And if we did, if we taught civics, if the Schoolhouse Rock was still on and people could see how a bill becomes a law, I mean, I've used that in trainings in
yeah.
the past. If people understood how government works and that, yes, it's give and take, and yes, it's ugly, and yes, you don't want to know how the sausage is made. I mean, that's one of the old adages about, lobbying and all the rest of that stuff and how politics works. But it impacts people's lives. And so it's important for people to understand how government works. And, people hate lobbyists. They hate the legislature. But they love it when things get done that they want to have done.
So let me go to Sienna. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, your thoughts on this.
I guess I'm just more middle of the road when it comes to this. I can patiently wait for the findings of the outside investigator that's going to be selected by the attorney general to do an investigation. I think that's the right way to go with this. Yes, I find it very ironic that, this Governor Cuomo, who in 2018 announced the sexual harassment prevention laws, regulations, and now look what he's going through after the Me Too movement. It's disappointing, but I'm patient enough to wait for the inquiry to be complete before we make any, resignation calls, so to speak.
And Malcolm Nance, your thoughts on this issue?
I do have some thoughts, believe it or not. I recall
that's why you're a panelist.
A couple of years ago that allegations very similar to this came out about the lieutenant governor of the state of Virginia. Was an up-and-coming black politician named Justin Fairfax. And the accusations were for someone who had said that she had had an assault sometime earlier, like 10 or 15 years earlier. Yeah, 2004, that's what it was, 15 years earlier. And at the time, we were in the midst of the entire Me Too movement. And that was supposed to, where the accuser absolutely, positively must be believed in every circumstance. And then when it came to this particular assault allegation, the lieutenant governor refused to resign. the governor himself was embroiled in a scandal where he may have been a person in a photograph wearing blackface. He refused to resign. And both of them are in office today. The investigation on Justin Fairfax came out to be inconclusive, and it disappeared right after the next election. You know, as a matter of fact, the Republicans in Virginia still don't call for his head as the way that they were calling for his head at the time. And then this leads up to the Tara Reid allegations against Joe Biden, which were weaponized by the Republican Party, still weaponized by them today, when they're not calling him a pedophile, they're calling him a rapist on the internet. If we have to resign every time there's an allegation, or two or three, then we won't have a governing, you know, we'll have one party, we'll constantly have every person resigning. And the other party will have a man with 24 accused rapes and sexual assaults, some of which are very well documented, who just flat out refuses to have any accountability whatsoever and is still hailed as their hero. So I think these things have to be investigated. Let the attorney general do her thing and carry out a fair and impartial investigation. But I got to tell you something. Today is the first time I heard there was a problem with bolts on the bridge, right, on the Cuomo Bridge. That's important. And we cannot stop governing the state of California. I'm sorry. Look, yeah, California. New York as well. We can't stop governing every time somebody comes up with an allegation of whatever it is. It has to be investigated.
So when it comes to this, so we only have about a minute before we have to go over to a break.
Well, can
so,
I have a second of that minute?
Yeah, sure.
Phil Wright.
I need you on mic, though.
Oh, yes. You're so right about that, as always. Phil writes, Cuomo and Allen. Hi, panel. Would Allen be sad not to have the access to the governor that he enjoys now? If Cuomo, and like that. The answer is, I don't have any access to him. For 8 years, I wrote nothing but critical columns about Cuomo. Then he came on, he did some shows with us, and it's been several months. And now we don't get any telephone calls. You know why? Because I asked them questions, one in which he used the N-word, you remember that, and then and several other things, like moving his mother from New York City for a holiday dinner to Albany. And that made international headlines. Come on now, I don't have access to him. Somebody called me yesterday and said, would you call the governor and please ask him this question for me? I said, he won't take that call. He doesn't even like me. So come on, stop with that stuff.
All right, we have a break and we're going to go take it. When we come back, we will continue. We have much more to discuss. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post make up our panel this morning. We welcome your letters. We ask that you keep them short and to the point. We'll get to as many as we possibly can in the time we have allotted. Panel at WAMC.org is where you can write to us. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue. First news from the BBC. Very appropriate music and a very good playlist this morning as we celebrate and bring to the forefront International Women's Day, which is today, March 8th. So we wish you all, we celebrate that this morning. And if you'd like to see the complete playlist, all you have to do is go to our website, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so we have letters here, and I want to get to them. I also, so we'll get to a couple of these, and then I want to bring up another point on this before we move on to other subjects. Kevin says, if the two legislative leaders would put aside their opinions on Cuomo's alleged indiscretions, as he is recommending while the attorney general investigates, the work could get done. Andrea Stewart-Cousins is on the list of potential candidates to unseat Cuomo next year. She should either declare that she is running and recuse herself or keep working on the budget. Then there is...
Wait. That's also true of Letitia James, right? In other words, more people are saying that she's setting herself up to run for governor than talking about Andrea Stewart-Cousins, and that's the first time I heard that one.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Let's see. We go to Mike, who says Cuomo. Different guy. Let's try it again. Cuomo is a bully, but he is New York's bully. I am a woke liberal man with a 17-year-old daughter, but I'm still supporting Governor Cuomo. Since when do allegations equal convictions? Is this the new way to remove a politician you disagree with? I agree with Libby about the bridge. Let's see what they find with the Mario Cuomo bridge. But until then, I support the governor. Then,
and I am telling you that, and I said it this morning, and I'll say it again, people don't like the legislature. You could look it up. They just don't like the legislature. It's supposed to be a democratic small d place where ideas are discussed. But everybody knows that the guys at the head of it, the people, the women, the men who are at the head of them, call the shots, and everybody else falls into line. Now, do they have conferences, and do they give their opinions? Of course they do. But in the end, it is anything but in the end, it's an oligarchy, and we all know it.
Antonia writes, please allow to let the legal system play out. Please do not laugh. The situation is not funny for anyone. The allegations may be found to be false, true, or not relevant. It is absurd to not believe that the legal system can be fair. There is hope that the legal system can be fair, be true to the facts. Well, let's go to the lawyer on the panel. Sienna, when it comes to that belief in the legal system, are we really talking about the legal system here?
Not really. What we're looking at is an investigation done by the attorney, outside investigator, looking at harassment charges, correct? So it's akin to when there's a big HR issue in a organization, and the organization is.
Oh, we're having cell issues with Sienna.
She'll come back.
Are you there? Okay. Well, all right. We are getting her back on the line, and we'll try to improve that connection. In the meantime, we'll go back to the letters. We got this that Michael says, can the New York State legislators censure the governor as the U.S. Congress can the president? That could make everyone happy. And then there is this letter from Jim, who said he did it, he said, but he didn't mean to offend, but he did. This is every abuser's story. Then Angela says, why can't the governor step aside while the investigation is going on and allow the lieutenant governor to take over on an interim basis in order to take some of the heat out of the room? And that seems hard to believe that would happen, but
it certainly does. And if you object to the idea that he should resign, you should object in the same way that he should remove himself from the process. Maybe he's been weakened. I think it's a good chance he has been weakened. But the negotiations will go forward. And trust me, folks, we're going to have a budget.
Rosemarie says there is a term called compartmentalizing. People are capable of temporarily putting aside the things going on in their lives and doing what they need to do. Is Governor Cuomo capable of compartmentalizing? It appears that this is his goal, according to yesterday's press briefing. Then Jim says, have you all gone insane? Except Alan, who is displaying patience. I am appalled by your behavior, by your rush to judgment, by your total willingness to lynch without knowing or understanding all of the facts. Shame on you. I don't know. It seemed like everybody wanted the investigation to play out. I don't understand the anger there.
Sound like that to me.
Sounded like what to you?
I'm pretty sure we were pretty much all calling for an investigation to play out. I didn't hear anybody crucifying
right.
The governor.
By the way, the governor was too. He said the same thing.
It's saying the collective rushes to judgment has lowered you in my eyes to the same level I hold for those KKK members from the South who were equally as happy hanging black men without waiting to discover the truth. Jim, I don't understand, but okay. If that were the mood of the room, I would agree with you, but it doesn't seem to be the mood of the room maybe we were listening to different programs.
And you know what, Joe? He's entitled to his opinion, just as the Times Union. The Albany newspaper called for the resignation of the governor.
But I would like to point out that they actually called for the resignation, where I don't think anyone on this panel did call for the resignation of the governor.
Right. That's true. Well, there was a sort of humma from Libby.
Oh, thanks, Alan.
Well, no, I mean you were not definitive about, because I asked you the question directly.
I said the investigation should continue, but I question the ability to govern. Those are two separate things.
Well, one leads to, okay.
I get it. One leads to the other. But this man is incredibly gifted politically. The issue is whether or not there are enough friends around to get him through this.
So there's
okay. So a guy goes before the jury, and the question as to whether he should be convicted is whether he has friends. Come on,
political friends, of course.
Any friends? I mean, I'm just trying to draw an analogy here about, you know, he's in tough shape if he doesn't have enough friends. Look, he is Andrew Tough Guy. I'm the guy who gave him the name, although it's being quoted without attribution all over the place. Andrew Tough Guy. And it bugs me. Come on. So, you know, everybody has an opinion. They're entitled to it. The newspaper's entitled to it. Everybody's entitled to it. But to me, there's a certain logic that is missing here.
All right. Allegations. There was an interesting article, I thought. This was sent to me last night from the Syracuse papers. And I would quote them if I had the actual... I have the article, but it's the
Post Standard.
There you go. Thank you. The Post Standard. Aren't you nice? Thank you.
Yeah.
I hope that is indeed the newspaper this came from. Allegations of sexual harassment and a scandal over New York's pandemic response to nursing home has sparked talks from some of impeaching Governor Andrew Cuomo. Republicans and even some Democrats are saying Cuomo must go either by resignation or removal from office. So this article goes into... So, and Alan, you touched on this earlier, you know, if you're going after the king, then, you know, I believe you used the word kill. We'll say, you know, get rid of.
Well, I'm not calling him the king. The analogy there is I'm not calling for killing Andrew Cuomo. I'm just saying that there's an old saying about if you go after the king, you better be sure to get him. Otherwise, parenthesis, he'll get you.
Right. So how does New York's impeachment process work? And I thought this was an interesting article. Who would take over if Cuomo is removed? And, of course, that would be the lieutenant governor. But New York impeachments began in the state assembly. According to the state constitution, a majority of the chamber's 150 members would have to vote in favor of impeaching Cuomo for the process to continue. An impeachment vote in the assembly is just a charge. It doesn't mean Cuomo is removed from office at that point. If the assembly votes in favor of impeachment, the matter goes to a special impeachment court established by the constitution for a trial. The Constitution also mandates that the lieutenant governor, currently Buffalo native Kathy Hochul, would serve as acting governor after Cuomo is impeached by the assembly and until the trial is finished. The state's impeachment court includes members of the state Senate and the seven judges on New York's Court of Appeals, the state's highest court.
That's where it goes wrong. If it was just the legislature with the heads of the legislative bodies, making the decision, they say, okay, convict him, he would be convicted. But with the Supreme Court, with the appointees of Cuomo on that court and the rest, forget it. It ain't going to happen.
The court normally includes the lieutenant governor as well, but that official is excluded if a governor is on trial. The temporary president of the Senate, currently Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, a Democrat, is also excluded from the impeachment court if a governor is on trial. Those exclusions would leave the court with 69 members. A two-thirds majority would be required to convict Cuomo and remove him from office. That's a total of 46 votes in favor of conviction. If Cuomo is convicted, Hochul would take over as governor and serve the remainder of Cuomo's current term. She'd have to run for governor in the 2022 election if she wanted a four-year term of her own. If Cuomo were convicted, lawmakers would also have the option to bar him from holding public office in the future. So there's a... When did we last hear that?
A familiar
plan. And if Cuomo were acquitted, Hochul would cease serving as acting governor and Cuomo would resume his duties. Hochul would return to serving as lieutenant governor and all would be back too.
But if Hochul became the governor, it would be antithetical to the provision in the New York State Constitution, which is written in invisible ink. In other words, sarcasm alert, you can't hear it, which says you can't be a Democratic governor unless you come from the five boroughs of New York City or very adjacent counties. So you know, you get the point, don't you?
Yeah.
You get the point that
there. Yeah, to stay there, right? To then run and to stay there.
Yeah, she would.
Yeah.
To get it.
All right. Libby, any thoughts on that plan?
Outburst from Alan.
No, not that. about impeachment and as a possibility. As an arrow in the quiver.
Yeah, I doubt it.
All right.
But there's a good chance it would happen if it were only the members of the legislature who would bow in order to the speaker and the majority leader. Remember, everybody hates the legislature.
Benjamin says, does the panel have any interest in discussing the five women who have accused the governor of this disgusting behavior? And please stop brushing it off as an allegation, singular. If Democrats are serious about protecting women and cleaning up politics, they need to have the guts to go after one of their own. And we got this one who says, Libby Cuomo saw the budget process through last year while dealing with the beginnings of the pandemic in New York, and he did a good job at both. He can do two things at once.
Oh, totally misconstrued what I was saying. Okay. Last year, and let me say, it's a total different political reality. Yes, he did a masterful job with the budget last year. Everybody said, you take care of this, Dad, because you were the state's dad last year. You were the only adult in the room in the country really standing up, explaining what was going on, all the rest of it. The governor, the legislature gave him the powers to do what he needed to do. He passed a budget based on the fiscal realities of what the pandemic was going to do to the state. I have no two ways about that.
Sienna,
this year, however, it's a little different because he's in a maelstrom of difficulty and scandal, which does impact one's ability to govern and one's ability to negotiate as hardball as he likes to. That's all.
Sienna,
he can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Any thoughts on the impeachment plan just outlined?
Oh, and sorry about earlier. I think I'm getting used to Opal and it knocked me off.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you back.
So in my mind, I don't think it's going to rise to the level of impeachment, unfortunately. But as always, you know, we're going to wait to see what happens with the investigation. I want to go back to the letter writer who said, you know, what about the five allegations? I think that's exactly what's happening. That's exactly what's happening in this Me Too movement. And you have the right to say, to voice your complaints. And I don't believe in cancel culture. I believe in consequences culture. And so now women have a place where they can come up and they can say what happened to them. And some people read it and they think it's inconsequential. Other people read it and they think that it's a big deal. But that's why the investigation needs to happen, so we can determine whether or not the governor should be held accountable to the point of resignation, to the point of impeachment. But I think it's very important, especially on Women's Day, to say that every woman should have the voice and be able to, you know, complain, or if she's uncomfortable in the workplace, she should be able to voice that. And she should be heard and the process should take place.
Malcolm, give you the last word before we take a break here.
Well, actually, I'd like to address something that was said by the person who had said in the letter, and that was about allegations. And, you know, the allegations, as I've seen them, do merit investigation, as we said before. But, you know, the writer ended it with, we should be able to go after our own. You shouldn't be able to go after anybody, right? I mean, this is not a witch hunt. We shouldn't be looking for things in which to take people down. If we find something comes up like this, you know, these allegations have, you know, and as you said, they may be something, they may be nothing, they may merit more investigation. But, you know, there's this thing within the Democratic Party to pile onto our own and destroy, you know, our leaders. And as you say, the state doesn't have, you know, most people in this state want this to play out. Even the governor has said it himself. But we've got to stop taking the let's witch hunt our own attitude towards everything that comes up within the party. And this is where, you know, like I said, the Republicans literally have people who, you know, Madison Cawthorn, the new Republican wunderkind, you know, who's a wheelchair-bound man, lied about his entire resume. And it turns out that he has numerous sexual assault allegations against him, including the allegation that the school was warning women about not getting into cars with him. So, you know, we can't have a double standard, but we can't have one standard on one side.
All right, let's pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll move on to some other issues. We have many to discuss this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post. I have a few letters I want to get to on the Cuomo issue, and then we'll move on to other things.
Hey, Joe.
Yo.
We just heard Beyonce on WAMC. That was amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is, isn't it? Kudos, and
it'll be great.
And we'll try to make it so that that is more frequent and not just on International Women's Day. Just for the record, we'll try for that. Don says, while trying to not take sides in the Cuomo resignation issue, a sufficient number of political leaders have been challenged on sexual exploitation with, as Malcolm points out, significantly varied apparent criteria and conclusions to say it is time to come up with some standards. It is certainly the right thing to take women's accusations very seriously, but a big but is it is not time to arrive at an objective set of standards a la the state's own anti-discrimination regulations to which anyone in a public or private workforce must adhere. I think I understand some of that. Bob says, Cuomo should push hard for legalizing recreational marijuana in the budget negotiations. It's a hugely popular position and will go a long way towards rehabilitating his image. All right. Jeff said the governor did a great job passing the budget last year. He passed the budget with record spending 1 month into the pandemic. Now he wants a federal bailout. The budget also indemnified the nursing homes, so relatives have no legal action to take their lost loved ones. So that from Jeff. All right. Any comments on that before we move on? Hearing none. We go to the news of other big news over the weekend was that the relief bill was the narrow relief bill, a narrow victory of the relief bill happened in the Senate. So President Biden and Democrats hailed the massive $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package that passed the Senate this weekend as a triumph of Democratic ideals, with Biden calling the legislation significant and historic. But the bill's passage on a tissue-thin paper, party-line vote after more than 24 hours of Senate debate belied the broader challenges facing Biden as he tries to navigate intra-party divisions to push through an ambitious agenda on voting rights, climate change, immigration, and other issues. The Relief Act's narrow slog through the 50-50 Senate revealed real disagreements between the Democratic Party's liberal and centrist wings, as well as Biden's instincts for procedure and bipartisanship. These and other disputes over the past week on issues ranging from the minimum wage to a new budget director also provided fresh warning signs for the rest of Biden's priorities, which will require a unified Democratic Party and little room for error against Republican opposition. Alan, I read this article from The Washington Post, and I thought to myself, well, we knew this, right? I mean, we knew that it was going to be tough.
It is. On the other hand,
50-50 is razor thin.
Let's take a look and see, or as the old children's song goes, let's take a look and see. And here's, and I'll be glad to sing it for you some other time. But here's what.
Call you on that.
He's got something approaching a 70% approval rating right now. Mm-hmm. He just got one of the most incredibly ambitious pieces of legislation through the Congress that anybody ever thought could be put through the Congress. He's got to protect Manchin because it's 50-50 in the Senate, right? 50-50. And the vice president breaks the tie. So, in fact, we know that he's got a tough road to hoe here. He's doing it, and he's doing it well. He spent a lot of years in the United States Senate, and he knows that while the filibuster should be abolished for the Democrats right now, that we have by-elections coming up in no time at all. The Republicans, if history is any indicator, has a very good chance of taking both the House and the Senate, but particularly the Senate, because that's where the filibuster exists. So he knows it makes no sense to cut your own throat for the sake of a couple of votes now and then to suffer under a Trumpian type of anti-democratic instinct that we had in this country for so long.
Libby?
I know, Alan, you're going to be shocked about this, but I agree with you. Biden.
Let the record show that on this eighth day of March in the year of our Lord 2021. Yes, go ahead.
Right. And we agree more than we disagree.
We do.
Joe Biden understands how politics works. He understands this country probably better than most politicians. He understands the Senate. He understands Congress. You know, he understands what it will take to keep his majorities in place, and he understands that Joe Manchin, while some of us would like to, you know, take him out to the woodshed, is key to all of this because Biden lost that state by triple digits, and so you have to negotiate. Governance is compromise and negotiation. And it can't be all one way or all the other. I mean, we saw what it was the last 4 years to have it almost all the other, right? It almost destroyed democracy. It almost destroyed the country. Biden wants to bring us back to the middle ground, which is where he is the most comfortable and can get the most done. This is a historic piece of legislation. You know, the press can blow this up all at once. Oh, it's paper thin. It's this, it's that, the other thing. Look, the Republicans were given the opportunity to make this bipartisan. They said no. The people understand that. 60% of the people or more wanted this to happen. People are suffering. They need help. They will recognize it was the Democrats who gave them the help, not the Republicans. Will all of them recognize that? No. The Republicans will have their 25-30% crazy vote on there for them, no matter what, because for them it's all about race. Otherwise, the middle of this country, the independents, the swing, they're seeing who's taking care of business, and it's Joe Biden and the Democrats.
All right, we're going to take a break, and I do want to hear from both Malcolm and Sienna on this issue of the relief bill and the narrow passage that took place over the weekend in the Senate. We'll pause here. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll continue after news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post making up the panel. Before we went to break, we were talking about the Senate's passing of the relief bill. The House is expected to vote on the relief bill tomorrow, and we talked about what kind of victory, quote unquote, this is. Malcolm, we're up to you. Let us, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just think it's great that Joe Biden right out the box got exactly what he needed, and more importantly, what the country needed. We really, really needed this relief. And, you know, I find it absolutely stunning
that the Republicans call this package a vote against the American worker, which is utterly amazing, because voting against it, which all of them did, you know, all of them did, they literally voted against everything the country stood, that everything people needed. They needed child care relief. They needed relief on work, even this $1,400 check, which is minuscule. I mean, Denmark is giving that much out to everyone every month. So this is it's a good victory for us. And if we have to deal with Manchin and play his little game, then so be it.
The Manchin game. Mm-hmm. Sienna, your thoughts?
I mean, I think I'll go back. I agree with everyone. But most importantly, I think it will impact the midterm elections, because I can just see the ads now saying that the Democrats voted for the Trump COVID bill. They voted in support of that. The Democrats voted again for another COVID bill, the recent one under Biden. And now the Republicans didn't vote for a bill that's going to help everyone, even in middle America. I don't think it was a good move strategically on the Republican side. They should have made this a more bipartisan effort, because this is what everyone needs. The child tax credit alone is going to impact majority of the middle class in the U.S. So I think it was just not a good move for the Republicans strategically not to vote for anyone to vote for this bill. Mm.
But as you know, Sienna, they're all scared to death of, you know, of Trump. And of Trump coming down, and he's already starting to campaign against people who voted for the few Republicans who voted for his, you know, his expulsion. So so they're scared of him. It's that simple. They just would, if they're putting up one thing against another, it all comes down to political survival for them. And that's what this is all about.
All right. Anybody else on that? Okay. Let's move on to another issue. Ray was just mentioning this in the newscast, and that is the George Floyd murder trial. So now the big deal is trying to find an impartial jury. Jury selection is scheduled to begin on Monday, that's today, for Derek Chauvin, who is the former police officer charged in connection with Mr. Floyd's death. So the questionnaire has gone out. The jury selection will begin today. And they have built this courtroom to comply with pandemic protocols. It's outfitted with television cameras. This is going to be in our living rooms. And Mr. Chauvin is charged with second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. Before his trial begins, he could face an additional charge of third-degree murder. The Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled on Friday in a decision that could delay the start of jury selection because Mr. Chauvin has the option to appeal that. Trials in police killings are rare. This one comes during a seismic shift in attitudes about race, racism, and policing, sparked in large part by the video showing Mr. Floyd pinned underneath officers for more than 9 minutes. The video show him crying for his mother as onlookers pleaded with the officers to let him breathe. So, Sienna, let's begin with you with a legal perspective in the first part of this New York Times story about finding an impartial jury and what jury selection will be like in a trial, a sensational trial like this, and then how you go from there to hopefully actually find justice.
Well, I like to start by being very clear that I think a lot of the press is saying that they're looking for a jury a juror that doesn't know about what happened with George Floyd. That is not the standard. The standard is you're looking for a juror that can be fair and base their decision on the facts presented to them only in the court, you know, and allowed into the trial by the judge. So that's what they're looking for. Now that's going to be, I agree, it's going to be very hard to find someone with no sort of bias in that county. However, it can be done, and we know it can be done because we had, they were able to find a jury for the Trayvon Martin trial down in Florida, and they were able to keep it in the county where the crime occurred. And I think that's the most important thing for me as a lawyer watching this, is I want to make sure this stays in the county where the crime occurred. I think the fear is that the judge may reconsider and decide to allow them to move it.
And then we're looking at a whole different jury pool. And I don't think that jury pool will be as fair to the defense and to the prosecution and the defense. So I think that's my perspective on it right now, is just remembering what the basic standard is for a juror and trying to keep it in the county where the crime occurred.
Malcolm Nance.
I'm just, you know, I don't think that there's going to be any violence, which I think some people are going to be on the lookout for should this trial go awry in some way. But right now, you know, choosing the jury is a relatively benign thing. But, you know, as the trial starts, starts, passions are going to get high out there. And good God forbid that, you know, there be some mitigating circumstance in a few months as we lead into the summer, and when most people are going to be getting vaccinated. And, you know, this summer, late summer, we might be heading towards a return to normal, and that this guy gets off, despite the fact that we all saw or can see his, you know, him kill a human being by kneeling on his neck.
Well, chance he won't, right, Malcolm? There's a very good chance, though, that he will get off. I say that because all you need is one foolish person on a jury, one racist on a jury, one person who says, "Yeah, he had to do it. He was sitting on his neck for a good reason," which I, of course, reject out of hand. And by the way, I do think there's a very good chance of violence after if a not guilty plea or a hung jury plea comes out. I think you will see some real violence.
Malcolm.
Yeah, I certainly hope not. And, you know, you're right. I mean, if one person hangs the jury, then they can retry him. But that's going to lead to violence. And now we're not just seeing violence. We're seeing the other side, right? We're seeing the pro-Trump paramilitaries come out onto these streets now. They don't stay in the suburbs anymore. They're doing the Kyle Rittenhouse thing, coming down with guns. So let's just hope that cool heads prevail. Let's get the jury impaneled, and let's hope that it's a relatively swift trial. Because you know what? I am not one to deny my lying eyes, right? I know what I saw. And I watched every moment of it, and you know uncalled for, and you know, we shall see. Let justice prevail.
Libby Post.
You know, it could be a long, hot summer. I agree that it's going to be very difficult to find an impartial jury. You know, this isn't like, with the 24/7 news cycle and social media, it's very hard for people to not know what happened. And so to find an impartial jury in Minnesota at all, I think is going to be difficult. The racial dynamics of this is going to make it even more difficult. It's going to be interesting to see how they seat the jury and whether or not they can find people. But Alan is right. You just need one holdout. And you need one holdout who's really good at fooling people during voir dire, and then can, you know, really manipulate the process going through jury deliberations. Look, this man was killed. It's just that simple. And I don't know that he'll get off so easily as other cops have. Simply because this was shown on national television. Everybody saw it. Everybody heard his cries for his mother. I mean, it was, you know, heartbreaking. And so I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. You know, I can't really talk to the legalities of all this, but I can say that it's going to be very difficult to find 12 impartial men and women of diverse backgrounds who will be able to come to this without any preconceived notions.
You know, we probably ought to go to our lawyer on the panel. No, you did a great job, Christine. But to ask the question about the voir dire itself. So the thing is, you just said it may be that somebody is good at, you know, at basically misrepresenting themselves in order to get who is for acquittal to get onto that jury. On the other hand, the voir dire is interesting in that everybody gets a crack at these potential jurors. Now, there are limits on how long you can go, and each state has different, and each county has, state has different rules on the voir dire. But it is, it would be interesting to me that to understand that the lawyers for the accused understand who their best chance of finding such a person who would vote to acquit would be. So it's not only that the guy's trying or the woman is trying to fool them, it's also that the lawyers have a pretty good idea, and they hire consultants, you know, on this thing to sort of spot some of those chinks in the armor.
And I would agree. This is, I've done voir dire when I practiced down in Georgia for jury trials, and it's one of the most important parts of your case. And so you're not just sitting there as a prosecutor or a defense attorney looking at these, you know, just trying to guess. Everyone, you have a team behind you. People are passing you notes. This person looked up when they said this. Everyone's watching.
Right.
The jury, this person doesn't look right. Cause I, you know, and then you have to remember that you have two different ways to get a juror off the panel. You have the, you get rid of them for cause. If you can prove to the judge that they will not be able to be impartial. So you can get those, and that's unlimited, right? So you make an argument to the judge for cause. This person needs to go because they have their father is a police officer. There's no way they can be, you know, impartial. And then I looked it up, and in Minnesota, the defense has 16 peremptory challenges, which means they get rid of someone for any reason, and the prosecution has 9. And so they can get rid of any juror for any reason. And before they come up with the final 12 and the 4 alternates. So
that's interesting. So you're saying that the prosecution does not have those peremptory challenges.
They have 9. Defense
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yes. So that's part. As a former defense attorney, we need all 16. You're going in with your hands kind of, you know, you don't have as many benefits as the prosecution, so to speak. And so I understand that, not for this George Floyd case, obviously, but that's just the way it works in the criminal system. But they have the defense of 16, and that is, and they get rid of anyone for any reason. So that's what you see happening in a voir dire, and it's very intense, it's very deliberate, and it's where attorneys do their best work, actually, is figuring out who they can get off their juror. For example, when I did a DUI trial, I'm looking for that person, and I was a defense attorney. I'm looking for a juror that has a drink at the restaurant and then drives home, because I know they're going to be more sympathetic to my client if I put that story, if that's my theory. And so I'm looking to keep that individual who has a drink at dinner. And to a layperson listening to an attorney, they may not think anything of that question, but I'm trying to make those connections so they can connect to my closing argument. So it's, you know, voir dire is the most important part of a jury trial, I would argue.
Why is it, I'm interested, Sienna, in your perspective on this. We've talked a lot about it over the years, but why is it so difficult, and especially in this particular case? And Libby stated that, you know, it may not be as difficult here, but why is it so difficult to convict a police officer?
Because there's a different standard, and there's a different standard for police officers in terms of the amount of force they're allowed to use. And people have a preconceived notion that police officers are there to protect. I mean, not preconceived. That's what their job is to protect the individual. So obviously they're making the best decision for the community at large and for the safety of the community. And that's what that's usually, this is a flip case, but usually, you know, that's what the defense is going to be arguing, is that he was protecting the community at large from in this case, George Floyd, but from the defendant. And they had to make a call. They had to make a call in a short amount of time about what was the right thing to do. And that is a compelling argument. And remember, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. So if there's even a reasonable doubt, if there's even a little pebble of doubt in your mind, jurors, you have to you have to find them not guilty.
Mm. And we
so
have to remember
really high.
Down.
And we have to remember who police officers are. I mean, it's no secret. Not all police officers are bigots or right-wingers or whatever else. But a lot of people who come into law enforcement come in from a particular perspective. And we know that. There have been studies on this. And that is something else, Sienna, that a point that you make, that the larger community knows who their police officers are. And we permit it.
All right, let's move on to some other stuff here as we have a few minutes before we have to go to our bottom of the hour break. So we'll go to this story, and Malcolm, I'll start with you on this because I think you're our guy on this. But let's talk about the war on terrorism and war powers and all that. President Biden is seeking an update for a much stretched law that authorizes the war on terrorism. The legal basis for the war against Al-Qaeda and its successors is aging and frayed, but how to replace it has long bedeviled lawmakers. President Biden wants to work with Congress to repeal and replace a war authorization law passed shortly after 9/11. White House officials said on Friday that law has been stretched across four administrations to permit open-ended combat against Islamist militant groups scattered across the world. The Biden administration is committed to working with Congress, quote, to ensure that the authorization for the use of military force currently on the books are replaced with a narrow and specific framework that will ensure that we can protect Americans from terrorist threats while ending the forever wars. That from President Biden's press secretary, Jen Psaki. So,
well, I have some strong views about that. He's right. What we had after 9/11 and what we have today is essentially saying that anything in the world, if we can even remotely connect it to a foreign power, you know, or terrorist group like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or any derivative of them, you can pretty much just go to war and do whatever you want. And I think that we're well past that now. The war on terror, which was a misnomer from go, right? It should have been a war on Al-Qaeda. Boom. But the war on terror, can be defined as anything. And if there's anything that I think the Republicans would like to do, and I know they're loath to do anything and make any changes that, does not recognize Islamic extremism as their number one type of terror. But you would think that the Republicans would be happy with this, because according to the War Powers Act, you could collect against and monitor some American citizens on the suspicion that they may be connected to a foreign power. And by extension, you could extend that to right-wing extremism if you wanted to, by just fudging it and saying maybe they're involved with, the Islamic State or some other country or some other group. I think it needs an entire revamp. And it will also give us the opportunity to close Guantanamo Bay, which, I'm sorry, that was a waste of time. I think we have, we barely have any real Al-Qaeda members in there. And the ones that we do should go to the Supermax in Colorado, along with all the other Al-Qaeda guys that we had been getting for decades. So, I think it's time for us to re-engineer this, because we're not in a war on terror anymore. Terrorism is a phenomenon which now rears its ugly head from time to time. Everyone is all hell-bent to go after Muslim terrorists. But now we have a big problem in our own country, our own insiders who are planning and plotting acts of terrorism. So maybe we should take a more holistic approach.
So in taking that holistic approach and what the president is trying to do and his administration is trying to do here, what are the challenges? What are the roadblocks going to be down the road? Because obviously this is a hard one for all parties involved.
Well, the roadblock is going to be the Republicans, because as I just said, they have this image, they have this thing in their head that terrorism can only be performed by people of the Muslim faith or as they would like to redefine it. I mean, I testified before Congress just 10 days ago, and they brought this extremist sympathizer journalist with them who wrote a whole book calling Black Lives Matter and Antifa terrorists. Well, rule number one for terrorists is you actually have to have an organization. You can't do a war against a philosophy. So Republicans are going to be loath to do anything that takes away their ability to label whom they want a terrorist. But, you know, this war is going on long enough. I mean, we don't even give medals out for the global war on terrorism anymore. But we do have terrorist enemies around the world, and we also have new challenges that fall under terrorism. What if Russia commits an act of terrorism like they did in Britain, which was using a weapon of mass destruction? They did it twice. They used polonium, a nuclear byproduct from atomic bombs, and then they used Novichok, which was a chemical weapon, and attacked people in England twice with these weapon systems. That's terrorism by all definitions. It's technically an act of war. So they really need to re-engineer this.
Alan, your thoughts on the president trying to get this through?
Well, the truth of the matter is, I could listen to Malcolm on this all day long. And for me to offer basically uninformed opinion, sounds reasonable to me that he wants to do these reforms, because we saw what Trump could do using existing law or his own prerogatives to really get us into serious trouble. So I think at the very least, it makes some sense from where I'm sitting, and I'm sitting pretty far away.
Libby, given that Congress has for years struggled to reach any consensus about this question, what do you think?
I think it's time for Congress to take some action. I was going to say something a little more colorful, but we can't say that on the air.
Okay. Thank you for correcting it before.
Yes, you're welcome. So that's the pregnant pause. I mean, you know,
I'm at least 3 inches from the red dumb button. So
right. Okay.
I don't have to
reach over. The whole war on terror, as we know, as Malcolm said, it was a misnomer, and it was predicated on lies, and so it's time for us to stop predicating and basing our decisions on how to go to war on a set of lies that were proven to be lies after we invaded Iraq. And, you know, we invaded the wrong country, and we did it because Junior wanted to make sure he could rectify Daddy in terms of the Bushes. And we've been paying the price ever since.
All right. Sienna, we have less than a minute, but anything you'd like to add to that?
Just very briefly, I mean, I think this is why Biden has a 70% approval rating. He's doing what we put him in the office to do. He's closing loopholes. He's narrowing his own power by, you know, backing this. And I just think this is exactly what we voted him in to do, and that's what he's doing.
All right, we'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and have our last segment together with our terrific panel this morning. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC. .org, panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back after this break and news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Also with us is our magnificent panel, Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post. Panel, does anyone want to talk about the interview between Oprah Winfrey and Meghan and Harry? Because that's all I want to talk about. Does anyone?
Sure. All I can tell you is it has broken the Chartok family in two.
Oh, no.
Yeah. You know, Roselle is a great disbeliever in the royal family because she thinks it's time to, you know, have a democratic, basically small D country. And I think it's so great to have all that pomp and circumstance. And I think they would be foolish to give it up, because when people go to England, it's a great tourist attraction. People like it. Now, I know that's a hard argument for me to make. Nevertheless, that's the way I feel.
So this interview was extraordinary about how whatever standard you use for it is one of the few interviews I've ever seen that actually lived up to the hype, I think, because how they were able to keep so many details under wraps for almost a month since the actual interview between Oprah Winfrey and Prince Harry and Meghan is fairly astonishing. So Meghan revealed suicidal thoughts. Prince Harry disclosed the rift with his father, as well as a distance that he has with his brother. There was just a jaw-dropping moment where Meghan, and then later confirmed by Prince Harry, that a member of the royal family, who Oprah Winfrey now has come out and said was not Prince Philip or the Queen, was concerned about...
It was his father.
Well, we don't know that, but
no,
we can.
I don't know that. I don't want to get sued again.
Yeah. So that was asking about the skin color of their child. Libby, what do you think?
I watched it, and, you know, you could see the visible pain on both of their faces. And the idea that someone would even ask that question it just shows, once again, how race divides and can be used as a wedge issue no matter where we are. And it always comes down to race. It really, really does. And the idea that Prince Harry fell in love with Meghan Markle. She went through the whole rigmarole as much as, you know, she said that she really didn't get prepped like she should have been prepped. It seems to me that somebody was hoping for her failure. But he loves his wife, and it's really clear that he loves that Harry loves Meghan, and that Harry was defined by what happened to his mother,
right?
The broken relationship there.
Malcolm.
I read yesterday, because this is a fascinating story. I mean, it's almost a clash between the old world and the new world. Mm-hmm. And somebody who wrote, you know, one of the internet, wits wrote that, you know, Harry loves Meghan in the way that Prince Charles never loved or defended Diana.
Right. And right. Absolutely.
It's becoming very clear. And that, you know, now we find out that he doesn't communicate with his father anymore. They don't take his calls.
Yeah.
This is about
long period of time. Yeah. Yeah.
Did they?
Well, up until last night, that probably screwed it up. Yeah, sure.
No, he said that he had stopped taking his calls.
He did. Yeah.
I don't think they
and then and then
today
he went
take his calls.
Right. Well, then he went back and said that, you know, since that time, he went, as he was telling the story, because it sort of dropped all of a sudden. He said, and then my dad stopped taking my calls. And then they clarified later, and they said that, you know, they had been talking, but there was still a lot of distance between the two, and there was a lot to work on in that relationship.
Now, Joe, Charles is the father, right?
Yes.
He's the father.
Yes.
Right.
And he's a rule breaker himself. I mean, let's face it. This is not a guy who has followed the rules. He was, you know, had the girlfriend, and he was not a good husband. And now he's, if it's so, hello, you got it. It's extraordinary that he's on his son for doing a thing motivated by love.
Well, to Malcolm's point, you know, and Harry said this, you know, he said, I thought I could have the support of my father who went through something very similar. And,
I must have missed that.
And yet, you know, and didn't. And I think that was very
a clue
telling.
Can I make one more point?
Yeah, of course.
This is going to be a reckoning for the crown. I'm a big Anglophile. I've been over there a few times. This is going to be a reckoning for them. If they don't jump up in the next few days and fully embrace that couple and say that, you know, with all of that's bygones, that's never going to happen. We endorse our diversity and even offer for them to come back into the family, then this may be very, very dangerous for them.
Good point. You know, and by the way, there was no criticism of the Queen, who apparently comes off pretty well in all of this.
Well, Harry made it very clear that they have a good relationship. Yes, Libby.
Yeah, I found that part of it fascinating, that they had such a good relationship with the Queen, and which begs the question, who's really in charge then? So that's number one. But I thought Meghan made a really good point that, you know, when they travel the Commonwealth, the majority, there's a lot of people of color in the Commonwealth, throughout the Commonwealth. And here was an opportunity for the royal family to embrace the everyone in the Commonwealth, and they couldn't take advantage of it. And I do think it's Charles and Camilla who has created this rift. I have no proof, but that's just my take on it. And I think William,
as Kelly and I were saying last night, we don't have any proof, but boy, we know.
Right. You know,
wasn't Camilla in 10,000 Dalmatians or something like that?
That's Cruella.
No, that's Cruella.
Oh, Cruella.
But you know, there's something to be, there's a slight, you know, resemblance. But nonetheless,
really, Libby, go ahead.
Well, all right, come on. I mean, look, it's all conjecture. We can say whatever we want now. But I wonder where William really is on all of this. I mean, you know, he's always been the heir apparent in many ways, and he is the heir apparent. And you know, the whole notion of service and duty, you know, has that trumped the relationship with his brother.
Now, Sienna, any thoughts? You have been, I don't know if you are silent just because we've been jumping all over it, or you, I don't want to get involved in this. Yeah,
right. I've been enjoying this. I watched that with my mouth open the whole night.
Yeah.
I was looking at the topics right there. I was like, Como or Meghan Markle? And I'm like, I'm watching Markle.
Yeah. It was a palate cleanser.
I know. It was just, what was so striking to me is the way they cut them off. I mean, I don't know how they decided to lay out that interview, but they made a case that's going to be very hard for the Crown to come against. I mean, she was detailed down to the day that she was, you know, having these suicidal thoughts, and she had to hold his hand tight. And then they brought the camera in to show you how she was holding Harry's hand tight that day because he couldn't leave her alone because she was suicidal. I mean, the way they laid that interview out was so well done. And she was very credible. Oh. She was very specific about things.
I agree with you 100%. And I have to say, I have been, even on this program, I have been very critical. I have a love-hate relationship with Oprah Winfrey. I thought, and for reasons I don't want to get into, but I will say I thought she gave a masterclass last night on interviewing. She was fantastic. Absolutely unbelievable.
And but what I don't understand is the security issue.
I don't get that either.
Why?
Why would they do that? Because I thought initially when Meghan was called, so for people who didn't see the interview, there was a part where Meghan Markle is saying that what they said was, okay, because we're gonna strip your children of any titles, royal titles, as such, they will not have any security. And so I thought it was just the kids. And then as Harry starts to talk, you realize that, no, it was the entire family that Harry, Meghan, and the child, Archie, would not have any security clearance or would have any security. Meanwhile, they're at the height, as Harry pointed out, they're at the height of getting death threats because of the press's rabid, racism that they are doing in England. I don't understand that either, Libby. That was another jaw-dropping moment where you're just like, really? I mean, how do you not protect? I mean, it's not like they don't have the money.
Right.
Exactly.
But don't you think it's so cool that there is now an American branch of the British royalty in this country? This is our prince.
Yeah. And he seems to, even though he said England will always be home, he seems very comfortable there. I thought the other telling moment, you were all talking about a moment ago about the relationship with the Queen. I thought the other telling moment was when they mentioned about Prince Philip and still being hospitalized. This is when they were in the chicken coop. And if you haven't seen it, just trust me, they were in a chicken coop. And Megan said, well, yeah, when we heard, the first thing I did is I called the Queen. And you know, that gives you some insight into that relationship, I thought, which was very interesting. All right.
I think
go ahead, Malcolm.
One last point. The Queen is going to put the knife in this thing. She's either going to say, okay, all of this is over with. They get full treatment. Or, you know, she's not. I mean, it's as simple as this. It's going to be very interesting to see how England handles this.
As Kelly and I went to bed last night, my wife, who is a practitioner in the art of public relations, I said, so how would you like to be working in the comms department of the of the Buckingham Palace this morning? And she said, no, I would not. As the BBC said this morning, they knew it was going to be bad. They had no idea it was going to be this bad. All right, folks, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Thank you for being so terrific with us this morning and talking about all kinds of stuff. Alan Shartok, thank you.
You are terrific, Joe. Thank you.
And to you, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Malcolm Nance, Libby Post, thank you so much. We will be right back after this.